Monster Man, special episode, Hags, Witches, and Deals with the Devil.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Eric. If you'd like to be like Eric and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, which is in the middle of a season about Egyptian mythology, and, you know, if you subscribe right now, you'll get nearly 100 previous episodes that you can listen to. So, Eric, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Now, Eric and I started off by talking about the idea of, like, deals, promises, bargains, contracts, those kinds of things that are such an important part of folklore and mythology, but can be quite tricky to implement in games. And the figure that we settled on when we were talking about this was the hag. So imagine my surprise when I, you know, went back and looked at the first edition hag, only to find that they're not particularly bargainers. I must have got this from a later edition, but we're going to stick with the figure of the witch making deals anyway. Obviously, these discussions apply to all kinds of different monsters, to devils, to fairies, what have you. One thing that I think is interesting about the D&D hag, specifically applying to this, is that hags have all the appearance of, you know, a witch, right? Like of the kind of cartoon stereotype of a witch, of a, you know, an old woman with a long crooked nose and straggly hair and so forth, but they're not actually humans at all. They're extra-dimensional creatures. And this, I think, is in keeping with a lot of kind of early folklore relating to hags. Or as we've seen with other monsters, there's a blurring of the lines between a witch and a monster. You know, you and I would tend to think, oh, a witch is a person who does magic, but a monster is not a person. But I don't think that that's clear at all. So I think that's actually not too out of line. So the night hag, which is your kind of basic level hag, I think even though it doesn't specify the bargain making thing in its monster manual entry, we do get some information that's going to help us contextualize the night hag's relationship with evil, which tells us a little bit about what it might be trying to achieve. Specifically, the night hag kind of hunts evil souls, right? So it will attack good creatures and it will fight with them, but it doesn't really get anything out of it. So typically they're not as aggressive as all that. They only attack when they think they have a good chance of winning. And normally what they do is they enchant people, they put them to sleep, and then they like ride them around, like they jump on their backs and ride them around. And this kind of like drains the victim's life force. They do it night after night after night until finally the target dies. And what they want to do is do this to people who are chaotic evil, because they're looking to create demons. You know, essentially they're trading souls to hell, which means that they kind of want to kill evil people. And if they can't find sufficiently evil people, I think we can infer they'll have to make them. And I think that there's a distant connection between this and how witch characters often behave in folklore, which is that witch characters often like establish rules that characters are not supposed to violate. The most obvious example of this would be if you go back to our special episode about Baba Yaga. You know, Baba Yaga gives all these tasks to Vasilisa, assuming that Vasilisa will not be able to complete them. And when she does, you know, Baba Yaga's kind of evil plan is foiled. The rules that Baba Yaga establishes both threaten and protect Vasilisa. Now, this is pretty lawful behavior, maybe not what we'd expect from a chaotic evil monster, so maybe just something to return to at a later time, but I wanted to address a more fundamental problem of deal-making monsters, which is that it's easy to get a good-hearted orphan girl to agree to a sinister old woman's terms, but it's much harder to get a half-orc assassin to do it. They're a suspicious lot, your half-orc assassins. In my experience, player characters are typically very unwilling to engage in these kinds of bargains, and therefore published scenarios that require them sort of tend to put a gun to the PC's heads, which naturally leaves a bad taste in their mouths. I don't know, you know, PCs aren't necessarily cynical, but players often have a cynical attitude toward what they may see as an attempt by the GM to railroad or entrap them. Typically having more agency than a good-hearted orphan girl, they'll often reject monstrous contracts or look for ways around them. Now, when players do this, it is not a good idea to kind of try to shoehorn them back into the situation that you've envisioned, because what they're telling you a lot of the time is that they don't think that this experience is going to be fun. So we need to think about ways not only to make it fun, but also to make it clear to the players that it's going to be fun. Now, maybe you rely on previous experience, maybe you just come out and talk out of character about it, but there has to be some way to make it clear to the players that this is not a setup. You know, a lot of players have been scarred by mean-spirited GM shenanigans. Like, you don't want to set up a deal that the PCs accept because that's the genre, and then get beaned and the GM laughs at you. This is particularly common, I feel like in older school D&D and in kind of 90s-y games. You know, not like AD&D second, but your Shadows Run, your Vampires the Masquerade, where there was sort of this thing that in order to prove you were a serious role player, you had to accept these scenes where your characters were bullied and humiliated while the GM power tripped on you with super powerful NPCs who the story was really about. And, you know, if you could accept that you weren't the main character and that you weren't engaging in some juvenile power fantasy, well, then you were a real role player. Now, how the GM was not engaging in a juvenile power fantasy, I have no idea, but I think that, like, hopeless situations and contracts with the devil smack of railroading to some players. So you have to be a bit cautious about that. You have to find a way to make sure that the PCs know that this is going to lead to fun situations rather than a reminder of the hopelessness of existence. You know, maybe I've played a lot of weird games. In order to do that, you have to do thing number two, which is make the bargain something that they really want. And this is tricky because, in general, story protagonists are often defined by a need. You know, whether that's you're a queen and you want so badly to have a child, or you're a yearning farmhand and you'd do anything to get off of this farm and lead a life of adventure, or whatever. Story protagonists are often strongly motivated by wanting something so badly that they'll do something that kind of otherwise doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense in order to achieve that. Having a character want something that's actually kind of hopeless is often a pretty good motivation. So in those stories, those petitioners, that is to say, the people who want something from the witch, which the witch in turn can grant, are motivated by a strong desire for something that the witch can do. But PCs, because they're often designed to fit into any old scenario, are less often defined by a strong specific need and more by kind of hooks that attach them to adventure storytelling more broadly. So I am a scoundrel constantly on the lookout for financial advantage. I am a do-gooder who wants to right wrongs and protect the innocent. I am a mercenary and I'll work for whoever pays me. You know, those are adaptable motivations that can fit into a wide number of different scenarios. But what that means is that there tends not to be any one thing that you need so much that you'll be willing to do something obviously kind of silly in order to achieve it. Now, the obvious solution to this is to have the witch, the devil, the whatever, have some kind of access to something that the PCs need within a scenario-specific context, right? So they need the blue jewel, and, you know, maybe the hag knows where the blue jewel is hidden. This works okay. Usually, because it's not like a fundamental desire of the PCs, it's only, so, you know, they're not like emotionally motivated to find the blue jewel. They're only kind of strategically motivated to find the blue jewel. It maybe doesn't have the same oomph. In a perfect world, you'd be able to emotionally attach the prospect of the bargain. You know, maybe it's to bring a party member that they all cared about back from the dead or something like that. If you're lucky, you know, you'll have player characters who also have strong personal desires for their characters. But again, you have the small problem that personal desires often don't resonate with the party as a whole. You know, this is an ensemble thing, and typically desires that are so profoundly emotional are personal. So it's a tricky balancing act. You have to find something that has an emotional oomph, but isn't specific to just one character. That's why a beloved party member is often a good thing, right? Because that is something that emerges from shared experience rather than from individual backstory. And you have to play fair. In fact, I think you probably have to play a little bit more than fair. Whether it's Baba Yaga and Vasilisa or the devil and Daniel Webster, the grantor is also a prisoner of the deal. Like we see with, say, Rumpelstiltskin. And in fact, we often see that cheating that isn't specifically defined as cheating within the terms of the deal winds up being the thing that traps them, right? You know, a fairy godmother or a talking bird or something intervenes to help the protagonist. Now, I'm not saying that that should happen in a role-playing game, but you have to think of ways in which the situation could evolve that the grantor doesn't know about. People talk a lot about separating PC and player perspectives, but separating NPC and GM perspectives is, I think, a little bit more difficult because there are so many different NPCs and they all, you know, have different levels of knowledge. So you have to kind of remember there may be ways that the PCs could affect this bargain that the Granter does not know about. One thing that I think is really important in that is the frustration that's going to gradually develop from the hag, the devil, you know, the Granter. Baba Yaga is frustrated that Vasilisa is keeping to the contract, right, is following her rules, because the rules are meant to be impossible to follow. And if Vasilisa doesn't follow the rules, she'll be like a naughty child, and then Baba Yaga can, you know, gobble her up or take her magic, whatever it is. I don't remember. What you really want to do if you're a devil or a demon or a hag is set up a no-win situation. Let's say that you're a hag, and what you want to do is turn people chaotic evil so that you can then kill them, send them down to Heck to be turned into Lemures, and get, like, your percentage on the transaction. You then set the PCs up with a deal that they can either keep or break, but both situations are beneficial to you. So let's say your goal is, you know, you want to turn people chaotic evil. So then you get them into this deal where essentially they have to kill someone. So either they keep the deal, keep their word, and kill someone, which is evil, or they renege on the deal and break their word, which is chaotic. Last special episode, we talked about Changeling the Lost, and that's actually a thing in Changeling the Lost. It's possible to swear a pledge, an oath, with someone that could prevent them from hurting you as long as you keep the terms of the oath. But, as I said, the typical story is that the rules don't change, but the situation changes, or the situation at least is not what the hag or the devil imagined that it is. So that there's some way that the player characters can fulfill the oath without fulfilling it, if that makes sense. So let's take a look at some possible deals with the devil based around the idea of the PCs trying to find the blue jewel, right? So the PCs need the blue jewel. They know it used to be in such and such an area. They're exploring that region and they find a lonely cottage inhabited by an old lady. You know, and they get talking to her and she invites them in for some tea. And eventually she's like, "Oh, yes, dearies, I know where the blue jewel is hidden. But if you want it, you must grant an old woman's wish. Of course, you could say no. It would be a terrible shame if Lord Zergathrax used the blue jewel to cover all the lands in darkness." Oh, that Lord Zergathrax, such a nice young man, always so polite. So what does the hag want? Well, from here we go to a couple of different options. So you could go the full grimdark. "Return to me with the heart of an innocent." So, you know, maybe you just go out and straight up murder somebody, which is good for the hag's overall mission of turning people evil. But alternatively, you know, you could, like, dig up a saint, you could go out and not do anything and then claim that you have come back to the hag with the heart of an innocent, you know, because you yourself are innocent. You could do the fairy tale version, right? The Baba Yaga version. "You must do all of my chores for 1 week." And the PCs will be like, "Oh, this is easy." And then in the morning they have to get up and, like, milk the stench cow. You know, the animated milk pail is running around causing mischief and making it difficult for them. This is more of the challenge form of the deal with the devil, where the failure that's anticipated by the Granter is that the PCs simply won't be able to accomplish the terms of the contract because they have presented it in a way that makes it sound simple, but it's actually extremely difficult. "I just want 3 eggs for my breakfast." "Well, that doesn't sound hard." "Ah, but they must be dragon eggs," or whatever. And so the PCs then have to use their cunning and creativity to perform these tasks that a normal person would not have been expected to be able to perform. So that's just like a little mini scenario, and that can be good fun. The third version is, so I'm currently listening to episodes of the podcast You're Wrong About, and they're talking about a book that came out in the 1970s called The Satan Seller. That's Seller, S-E-L-L-E-R. It's a quote-unquote true story about a fellow who becomes a Satanist and then repents, right? I mean, obviously, it's all nonsense. But in it, he talks about what it is that motivates people to, like, sell their souls to Satan. And he says that it's essentially, you know, the prospect of the good life, that they're in it for, quote, "kicks, chicks, and checks." Clearly, that doesn't appeal to player characters in the same way. You know, even fabulous wealth, I think for most people, like, if I, James Holloway, had the prospect of fabulous wealth, that would be great. There'd be so many things I could do with it, both in a self-interested way, right? There'd be lots of things that I wouldn't have to worry about anymore, and also in an altruistic way, right? I could do a lot for others if I had fabulous wealth. But in a role-playing game, generally fabulous wealth, qua fabulous wealth, is not that interesting to player characters. They want fabulous wealth, either because it sort of signifies winning, I guess, or because they want to use it to buy, you know, magic weapons and armor. And other things, like more direct pleasures, are not really that exciting to RPG characters, simply because they're not real. People like a good meal more than they like having a good meal described to them. Although players do seem to like describing getting drunk, but in general, like, getting drunk is more enjoyable than hearing about someone getting drunk. Indeed, there's very few things not more enjoyable than hearing about how drunk somebody was. But what I mean is that the things that motivate flesh and blood people, both positively and negatively, don't apply to player characters to the same extent, right? Player characters never buy a Coke. You'd think that if we're not going to get very far with kicks, chicks, and checks, then we need to offer real ultimate power in order to get people to sell their souls to Satan. But that isn't my experience. My experience is that player characters will sell their souls to Satan at the slightest provocation. So in my 5th edition campaign, I ran a scenario in which the player characters were looking for, they needed to get into somewhere secure, I don't even remember, and the only person who knew how to rob this vault or whatever it was the distant ancestor of one of the party members, right? So they had this guy in their party who was a member of a big family of rogues. They were all like very posh rogues. They started out with this guy who was, you know, so-and-so, the gentleman thief. And then when one of the players wanted to create a new character, they created this guy's nephew who was so-and-so, the gentleman assassin. So they had to go find the first person who had the title of the gentleman thief. But of course, he'd been dead for a long time. So they had to actually go down and find him in hell, which is, you know, where he was because of all the stealing. And so they went down to hell, and in order basically to get past security, like to find a way to blend in, one of the player characters sold his soul to the devil so that he would then have like the devil's mark on him and be able to blend in. And that would, you know, it would look like here was this guy with the devil's mark on him, and he was just kind of like herding the others who were damned. Okay, fair enough. And then another one of the players jumps up and she says she wants to sell her soul to the devil. Like, it wasn't really necessary, but it's cool, right? Like, I want to be like, hey kids, sell your soul to Satan, it's cool. That's not what I'm saying, but I mean that from a narrative standpoint, it creates this tension. You know, they were concerned that if they died, they couldn't be resurrected, that their souls would just go straight to hell. And, you know, if they wanted them back, they'd have to do all this all over again. And then once they, like, essentially reneged on the deal and escaped from hell, every so often bounty hunters would show up. So they were at one point being tracked by a fury and her pack of hellhounds because, you know, this soul belonged now to Asmodeus or whoever, and he wanted it back. So for all that I've been saying, player characters are typically reluctant to sell their souls to Satan. Maybe the, like, bad to the bone credentials of doing so will motivate people, right? You know, every bard wants to have the legend that they sold their soul to the devil in order to learn to play the guitar so well or whatever, like Robert Johnson. So I guess what all of these boil down to is that the contract is going to be attractive to the players if the players look at it and they see an opportunity to do something fun. Not that they're engaging some kind of buy now, pay later deal, but that they're engaging in a buy now, have fun getting out of paying later deal. I don't have time to go into my traditional side bit about how the kind of economy of role-playing games is all messed up because player characters want to labor. In real life, people spend money to save themselves hard work. But in games, the hard work, the fun, the danger, the excitement is the point of the game. And therefore, getting into trouble is not a cost the player characters incur, but an opportunity that they seek. Well, the player characters may avoid it, but the players seek it out, if that makes sense. It needs to sound like you're going to get this thing now, and then later on you're going to get fun trouble, which is bad from your character's perspective, but fun from yours. And the reason that contracts often go wrong is because they're presented in a different way. They're presented as you're going to buy this thing now, but you're going to pay a heavy price later, and ooh, you'll suffer. And the player characters go, oh, I bet we can get that thing a different way. And they're usually right. I think this is especially challenging in editions of the game where it is assumed that for the most part, player characters are able to take on opponents that they encounter. So a group of first level AD&D characters who encounter this old sorceress would be well advised to tread gingerly around her because they have no idea how tough she is. But a group of 5th edition D&D characters who don't like the idea of taking her bargain may think, okay, well, this is essentially a trade-off. We can save what we would expend in this fight and take the deal, but if the long-term costs are greater, we might as well just fight her, and feel pretty confident in their ability to fight her. Not in every game, but that would be, I would think, the default assumption. And that's maybe something that you have to counteract, right? You have to say, well, you're going to get through this by negotiation or by trickery, but not by just beating up this devil. So I don't know that that necessarily amounts to a program, but I feel like those are my thoughts on how to pitch contracts. If you were really the person making the deal, what you would do is try to make the consequences of breaking the contract sound as terrible as possible. But as the GM, you want to sound like the person is trying to make it sound as bad as possible, while you yourself are actually trying to make it sound like fun. And when that happens, players will take the deal. So Eric, those are my thoughts on deals with the devil. I don't know why we assign them to hags, because I guess hags become like bargaining cult leader types later on. I swear I've done an episode where we talked about this concept, so it must be some other type of hag that's not called a hag. It's not the Annis, though, which is just a tougher night hag. But either way, I hope that you enjoyed the episode. Again, everyone else, if you'd like to be like Eric and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. We're gonna be looking at some familiar monsters, including, I think, some quite interesting ways that they've changed, some for better and some for worse. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.